This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
General housekeeping is out of the way. Let me introduce myself. I am Brittany Master, pronouns are she, her, and I'm really excited to be in this conversation with Renee and Regina and you all. I have been a reproductive justice activist for the past 17 years or so. I've entered this work when I needed support paying for an abortion about 17 years ago. Shout out to the Chicago Abortion Fund who funded that. I'm gonna plug them a lot more later, so be prepared, and also to become a recurring donor. I am currently the Associate Director of Political Education at the National Network of Abortion Funds. Yay, shout out to NNAF as well. So let's get into it. I want to introduce y'all to our panelists. We have Renee Brayson Sherman, pronouns are she, her, and Regina Mahone, pronouns are also she, her. They are the co-hosts of the podcast, The A-Files, A Secret History of Abortion, and they're co-authors of the forthcoming book, Liberating Abortion, Claiming Our History, Sharing Our Stories, and Building the Reproductive Future We Deserve. Y'all can get that in less than a month. We will also plug that later. Renee Brayson Sherman is a reproductive justice activist, abortion storyteller, and writer. She is the founder and co-executive director of We Testify, and executive producer of award-winning documentary Hours to Tell. She lives in Washington, D.C. Regina is, yes, give it up for Renee. We can do that here. Regina Mahone is a writer and editor whose work explores the intersections between race, class, and reproductive rights. As a senior editor at The Nation magazine, she edits articles on a range of topics, including national politics, and runs the monthly Repro Nation newsletter. And she lives in New Jersey with her partner and her two babies. Love us some parents here. We're excited to hear two exclusive readings from them on their book, Liberating Abortion, which comes out on October 1st. Then I'll moderate a conversation with Renee and Regina, and we'll give y'all some time to ponder some things and questions that we've discussed, and then we'll also have a Q&A. But y'all will be inside of a peer share, so just a heads up, find your buddy. All right, wonderful. Going to kick it off. Regina, you want to get started with the first reading?
Yes, thank you all so much for being here, especially on a Sunday morning at 10 a.m. when I'm sure you had a fabulous Saturday night, so thank you for coming out. So I'm going to be reading an abridged excerpt from our fifth chapter. It's called What's Race and Class Got to Do with It? And in that chapter, we retell the story of Rosie Jimenez, the first known woman to die as a result of the Hyde Amendment, which is the federal ban on abortion coverage for Medicaid recipients. By all accounts, Rosario Jimenez was deeply loved by all who knew her. Rosie, as she was known to her family and friends, was outgoing. Rosie was outgoing, loved to dance, and enjoyed dressing up and wearing wigs that signaled her unique style and vibrant presence. Rosie grew up in a large Mexican-American family in 1950s McAllen, Texas. Her parents were migrant farm workers traveling to work on agriculture fields, later opening a Mexican restaurant while raising 12 children. Like her family, Rosie was ambitious. The 27-year-old mother wanted more for her young daughter, Monique, than what she had growing up. Receiving a meager $86 a month in social service benefits, Rosie worked hourly wage jobs to make ends meet, including cleaning houses over the weekends to provide for herself and her daughter. After passing her GED test and enrolling in a government-sponsored program for secretarial school, Rosie enrolled at what was then called Pan Am University in 1974. Shortly before her death, she received a $700 financial aid check, but she refused to use that check on anything other than her education. Quote, she was going to college to have a better life. That was her goal, her daughter Monique said in a 2015 Texas Observer interview. I know that she saw my grandparents struggle and she wanted to provide me with a better life. Rosie would do anything for her daughter Monique. Rosie's story has become an iconic and dire warning within the reproductive justice movement. For nearly 50 years, her death has served as a symbol for activists advocating for an end to the Hyde Amendment, a budget amendment that bars the use of federal funds for abortion coverage for Medicaid and Medicare enrollees in many states, residents of Washington, D.C., federal employees, Peace Corps volunteers, and others. Although the Hyde Amendment certainly played a major role in Rosie's death, it was not the only player. But because Rosie's story had become larger than life in the movement, the full story and systemic failures, including those by people within the abortion care field, were overshadowed or erased. When we fail to tell a complete version of her story and the stories of countless others who have been affected by systemic injustices, we are destined to never learn from them. During our research for this book, we were surprised to learn that Rosie had 3 abortions after her daughter was born, one in 1975 and 2 in 1977. This shouldn't have been a surprise because most people who have abortions already have children, and nearly half have had more than one abortion. However, we were surprised that this fact had been omitted when her story was retold. There's a tendency to flatten abortion experiences in the media or for advocacy causes, to tell tidied up versions of our lives, to garner more sympathy and understanding. But all of us are much more complicated. For us, this fact changes the story a bit. Rather than the narrative we'd seen portrayed of a scared young woman who died with her financial check in hand, we see Rosie as a confident mother who knew that abortion was an option for her each and every time she needed it. Because they took place before the Hyde Amendment went into effect, Rosie's first 2 abortions were covered by her Medicaid insurance and performed at reputable clinics in McAllen and Harlingen, Texas. However, in September 1977, before she sought her 3rd abortion, the state of Texas changed abortion coverage based on the new rules of the Hyde Amendment. Rosie was confident that she did not want to continue the pregnancy. But without Medicaid coverage, she couldn't afford the price of an abortion at her local clinic. Due to the unsafe abortion, Rosie became septic and was hospitalized for several days. To try to keep her alive, the doctors performed a tracheotomy and then did a hysterectomy to try to identify the source of a severe pelvic infection. She continued to decline after the hysterectomy, and she died on October 3rd, 1977, 8 days after she was admitted to the hospital from kidney and heart failure, leaving her 4-year-old daughter in the care of family members. It's undeniable that Rosie became a national figure shortly after her death. Following national coverage, activists across the country held candlelight vigils, propping her up as an example of what happens when abortion is made inaccessible. Rosie's death has been turned into a lesson about anti-abortion policies. And it is a lesson, But by doing so, abortion activists have placed the blame for Rosie's death on one policy in particular, rather than the entire capitalist healthcare system, rife with policies and stigma fueled by racism that keeps people from being able to receive the care they need. The fact is that money, or lack of it, kept Rosie from receiving competent medical care, an issue that impacts communities today. Rosie was denied an abortion at a reputable clinic because she did not have the money to pay for her abortion upfront. And like so many others at the time, and since then, as we're seeing today, that is part of the tragedy of her death. The Hyde Amendment led to her death, but so did a system that values payment and profits over people. Unfortunately, this hasn't changed. In her book, No Real Choice: How Culture and Politics Matter for Reproductive Autonomy, sociologist Katrina Kimport writes about a young woman of color who was turned away from an abortion appointment because she didn't have cash to pay for her appointment and the clinic didn't accept credit cards or health insurance. By the time she realized this, the banks were closed and she wasn't able to get the money she needed or time off work for a subsequent appointment. She didn't choose to continue her pregnancy. Capitalism chose for her. Clinics, of course, need to be paid for their services so they can pay their workers, afford medical supplies, and keep the clinics open. Most barely make ends meet as it is. Everyone is making difficult decisions in an impossible situation set up to privilege the profits of health insurance companies and to serve only those who have the money and the access to healthcare that comes with money. If we were ever going to learn anything from Rosie's death, it should have been that the racist, classist systems rooted in capitalism that make it possible for abortions to be denied in the first place need to be dismantled. That includes the health insurance system that grants corporations and governments the authority over what healthcare is and isn't covered, and the medical system that gives doctors the power to turn patients in desperate need away because of how much money is in their bank account. It's the Medicaid system that plays Russian roulette with lives, determining who receives care based on legislators' whims and budgets. Until those systems are completely rebuilt with the people who need abortions at the center, they will never, ever meet the needs of Black and brown folks in this country.
All right, so I'm gonna do a second reading, and this is from our sixth chapter. Oh, is this close enough? Okay, great. So I'm gonna do a second reading. It's from our sixth chapter called Abortion-splaining, like mansplaining. I'm sure you've all been abortion-splained before, where in that chapter we go through several myths in which we've all been abortion-splained. And it starts with the ridiculous, from abortion causes hurricanes to abortion causes tornadoes, droughts. Did you know that it's powering the lights in Washington, D.C.? Fun fact. But also we get into the serious ones that get passed around, like abortion is Black genocide, abortion is slavery, abortion is the new Holocaust. And so this is a very short excerpt of one abortion-splaining myth, that abortion is bad for the economy. So I'm going to open with a quote. The abortion-splaining myth: abortion disappeared a generation of workers. Quote, the Joint Economic Committee Republicans estimate that the economic cost of abortion in 2019 alone, due to the loss of nearly 630,000 unborn lives, was at least $6.9 trillion, or 32% GDP. Abortion imposes an external cost on society not reflected in the JEC Republicans' $6.9 trillion cost estimate. In the long run, abortion shrinks the labor force, stunts innovation and limits economic growth. It also weakens the solvency of social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare that rely on workers to support a growing elderly population. That is from The Economic Cost of Abortion by the Joint Economic Committee Republicans from June 15th, 2022. In preparation for the unpopular overturn of Roe v. Wade, anti-abortion legislators began spreading a new argument. Abortion is detrimental to the economy. The reproductive justice movement has always argued that the ability to decide if, when, and how to grow a family is as much a bodily autonomy issue as it is an economic one. Half of people who have abortions have an income below the federal poverty level. More than 75% cannot afford their abortion or basic living expenses, which is part of the reason they're having an abortion to begin with. It's also pretty basic economics. If someone is forced to continue a pregnancy they weren't planning to because they couldn't access an abortion, the extra financial costs of another child would be difficult to overcome. The Turnaway study and every other economic analysis done on this topic has found that when women are denied or wanted an abortion, they're 3 times more likely to be unemployed and 4 times more likely to live in poverty than women who were less likely or who were able to access their abortions. The missing baby capital, as it's called, that reasoning, is an offshoot of the genocide argument. Kids are missing siblings. Parents are missing children. Companies are missing workers. The reasoning imagines missing people, but fundamentally ignores the children people are able to have when they are ready to continue a pregnancy. It ignores the financial stability people are able to achieve by delaying parenthood or spacing their children. The financial situation of people who have abortions is not what the anti-abortion movement is worried about. Rather, it's the lost capital babies could have made for companies, their absence from the tax base, and their non-existent Social Security and Medicare contributions. Anti-abortion activists have made arguments ranging from claiming that 22% of the workforce has been lost to fretting that billions in federal tax revenues are missing, all because of abortion. The truth is that abortion is a threat to capitalism. Under a capitalist system, every action and moment must produce wealth. Forcing people to continue pregnancies in order to create more workers is as old as slavery. The only value people are perceived to have is as labor. The luxury of leisure is available to those who can afford it. Abortion allows for leisurely, non-procreative sex. Feminist socialist scholar Silvia Federici explains that a tax on abortion will always go hand in hand with efforts to regulate a supply of labor. Quote, the new leaders of mercantile capitalism agree that the number of citizens determines a nation's wealth, she explains in Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. Quote, infanticide becomes a capital offense, end quote, because it is considered the destruction of potential labor. Similarly, in her book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone, labor journalist Sarah Jaffe writes about utopian socialist societies in the early 20th century that made domestic care work available to all through public schools, laundries, and cafeterias. Legalized abortion was critical to this utopia so that women could participate in the labor force, and their domestic and child-rearing work didn't subsidize cis men's labor achievements. Capitalism does not value pregnant people. If it did, there would be a system of financial and physical support for them and no need to work while pregnant or to go back to work while still healing from a pregnancy. And there would be adequate pay for caring for and raising children. Pregnant people work and exist to create more workers who will be socialized by the system to love nothing but work and create wealth for others while receiving little in return. This isn't a new concept. It's the idea behind chattel slavery. It's just been dressed up in new anti-abortion rhetoric and economic analysis. Thank you.
Child, is this on?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I just felt really awkward standing up there, so I'm going to stay here for the rest of this panel.
You. Your body, your choice.
Exactly, which is a great segue. before we jump into the actual questions I have prepared, I wanted to spend some time, one, thanking y'all for writing this book, for doing the research, for the lessons and reminders that abortion has been around for centuries across many different cultures. And it's an honor to be in the book. I shared my story in the book. And so thank you for that space. And also thank you for creating We Testify, Renee.
We love you.
Which I'll let you share more about, but this is like the segue into like, let's get into how we all know each other and possibly like came to this work. I mentioned briefly how I needed an abortion and Chicago Abortion Fund provided support for that. And then I believe I met you, Renee, maybe a decade ago in D.C. through a mutual friend. We had a lot of fun in that restaurant talking about abortion and the antis and just how fucked up it all is.
Yep.
And I was also in the inaugural cohort of We Testify as an abortion storyteller. So I'm going to pause there. If y'all could share more about how you entered this work. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, I met Renee also about a decade ago. I was working as an assistant editor, eventually becoming managing editor at an online publication called, today it's called Rewire News Group, but back then it was RH Reality Check. Mm-hmm. And I had started not long after I had an abortion, and I had not really seen a lot of Black women speaking about the connections between race and class and reproductive rights, and in such a empowered place, because a lot of my exposure to it was TV, was movies like the Dirty Dancing and the Degrassi episode and things like that. And so I really, in seeing Renee share her experience and write about her experience in such a succinct and impactful way, I was just incredibly moved by it. And then Renee was part of a cohort of Black women and non-binary folks called Echoing Ida, writing about these issues of reproductive justice. And I became Renee's editor, and it kind of happened where it was just like, oh, Regina, could you pick up this piece that Renee wrote? And as soon as I started working with her, I was like, okay, I'm gonna keep working with Renee, like if that's okay, everybody, that's cool. Just because I just immediately was drawn to her energy. Anyone who knows Renee knows you were drawn into that energy of just being supportive of people, unapologetically supportive of people who've had abortions, our whole experiences, not just one experience, but the fullness of our being. And it's really beautiful and wonderful. And so, of course, when we had an opportunity to work together on a book, I was just like, hell yes, like, let's do this. And shining a spotlight for me on parenthood, and because, parents are the people who have the majority of abortions, in reading the excerpt of Rosie's, like, I always get emotional because I think about my own children, mm-hmm. and what would happen in that situation, and it just shouldn't have happened. And so I'm just grateful that we can elevate her story in the context that we feel is right, which is around the entire system being called into question, and I'm gonna stop talking.
Thank you. I came to this work, next year will be 20 years ago in August that I had an abortion. when I was 19. And it was a moment in which I was quite lost in life. I was in a toxic relationship. And as soon as I realized that I was pregnant, I was like, yeah, no. My boyfriend was like sitting in the other room with his best friend, and they were playing, what was it, Madden 2005 at the time? Madden 2K5. And I mean, I remember crying in the bathroom at the positive pregnancy test, and he couldn't even hear me crying in the bathroom that was just next door. So I was like, well, he definitely won't be able to hear a baby cry. So, and I don't want to be pregnant. So I had an abortion. I maxed out my credit card to pay for it. The amount of time it took me to, I had to wait a week to get an appointment, which now, I mean, it was just like, oh, we have to wait till the following Friday when they are, have some openings and scheduling, right? So it's 2005, there were fewer restrictions than there are today in Illinois. Chicago, I had it just up the street, I'm from Evanston. But I was lucky, my clinic was 15 minutes away. And when I got there, or let me back up. I didn't think I could wait the week. So I've recently started talking about the fact that I actually attempted to self-manage my abortion through like immense amounts of alcohol. It doesn't work because that's not how the body works. But you can't tell somebody who doesn't want to be pregnant that. Even having an appointment scheduled and having to wait is really scary. And so I finally did get to my appointment. And I had insurance, but I didn't use it because if I did, it would say that I'd had an abortion on the explanation of benefits that would get sent to my parents, and I wasn't ready to tell them that I'd had an abortion. And I grew up in a pro-choice family, so I felt like, you know, I knew that abortion wasn't really frowned upon, but I didn't know anyone other than an older cousin and Lil' Kim who'd had abortions. And Lil' Kim wasn't picking up my phone calls. So, but she really was the only black woman that I knew. And even then, it was, at the time, it was kind of like rumors. Like, oh, she had had an abortion with Biggie, right? So I felt quite alone. So I maxed out a credit card. The credit card limit I had was $500. The abortion with the sedation, I sprung for the extra $100 for the Twilight sedation. So it was $450. At the time, I was working at Victoria's Secret, and I was making above minimum wage, $7.25 an hour. So I was really excited with that job. And it took me weeks to pay for the abortion, to pay it off on the credit card. And, you know, because I still had to pay for gas to get to work, which was the reason I couldn't afford the birth control to begin with, because it was before the Affordable Care Act, and I couldn't afford the $100 copay because it was costing me so much in gas to get to work. Like all of these, the reason I got pregnant was simply because A, I thought you couldn't get pregnant if you'd been on the pill for a long time and it was okay to miss some. No. But also I just couldn't afford simple things. Like, if we had a national health system, like, these would not be problems. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that, like, having a national health system would make abortion go away, because I think abortion should be around forever. It's not going to go away. I am not supportive of the, well, if we just make sure that there's more access to birth control, we can solve the abortion problem. Abortion is not a problem to be solved. Inequality is. People not being able to make their own decisions is the problem to be solved. People will always need abortions. Even IUDs don't always work. Talk to the storytellers in my program. But one of the things that excuse me, brought me to this work is that when I had my abortion, I didn't know any other black and brown folks who'd had abortions. And so I kept my story a secret for 6 years. Until I met other people and we'd had lunch and they were talking about our abortions openly. And I was like, whoa, this is wild. So I started sharing my story. And even then, I was still one of the only folks of color, always usually the only person of color to be on the panel talking about and representing all people of color. And also all people who had a difficult time affording their abortions. But when you look at the data, that's not, like, people, that is who has abortions. The majority are people of color. The majority are people who can't afford it. So why is it that our own movement is not putting up the majority of people who have abortions as the face of it, right? The easy answer is racism and classism. Our movement, the nonprofit industrial complex, is run by wealthy white women, most of whom had not had abortions, I later found out, which is kind of why I started the organization I run, We Testify, working with people who have abortions to share their abortion stories at the intersection of race, class, and gender identity. But what I also found was that when those of us who are of color and who talk about these things, such as economic injustices and the barriers that we faced, it creates space for more of us to share our stories and to talk about that. Because what people end up feeling like is, oh, my story isn't compelling enough because I wasn't almost dying, or because it wasn't a wanted pregnancy. And then that actually means that the majority of people who have abortions don't get to hear someone who looks like them and sounds like them and has a story like them talking about it. Some of you might not know, but it's quite rad. This panel right now, just all three of us being black women who've had abortions, is radical. Next time you go to an abortion panel, check to see how many have actually had abortions and how many are of color. Because I watch white panel, all white panels, people who haven't had abortions all the time. We are not centered in our own movement. Our issues are not elevated in our own movement. And I think that that is what is so powerful, in that just by, you know, sharing a story that we can build connection and look at the things we've been able to create in making sure that economic justice and abortion access is available to all of us. So I'll pause there. That was a little long, but it was my little diatribe.
Now, I love what you just ended with, because I am reminded of work I was doing maybe like in 2019 when I would talk to folks who've had abortions. And one of the last questions I'd asked is, what was made more possible because of your abortion? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about We Testify. I'm thinking about my own trajectory, and I think that's something to ponder and to sit with, because it's kind of opposite of what we see in media and in society about, oh, there's a sad story around abortion. Don't get me wrong, that's some folks' experience. Mine was a very easy decision, and I felt relieved. But there are plenty of possibilities, and one being this panel with all black women.
Hello. Well, can I also say that, like, I think about how many of your kids' lives are available because are here because you had an abortion. Mm-hmm. Your kiddos, right? My mom had an abortion before I was born. Her decision made it so that I can irritate a whole lot of people every day. Because I get, like, the anti-abortion folks sort of being like, well, you know, what about the kid you had, and what if, or, you know, what if your mom had had an abortion? She did, and that's why I'm here annoying the fuck out of you. I am what happens. Her kiddos are what happens. Brittany's kiddos are what happens. This book is what happens when we get to decide what's best for us. That is so critical. And I think sort of along the lines of what I read, this, like, abortion disappears a generation. They're looking at what's missing, but they refuse to look at what's present because that doesn't benefit them. It means it's people like me who are able to talk back. It means someone like people like us who are able to write a book dispelling all the myths that they have y'all in a chokehold over. That is what is possible. And yes, economic growth, whatever. I mean, Democrats like that argument. It's not mine, but whatever.
When the focus is so much on what we produce as workers, as people who can bear children, of course, then it's, well, then you're taking away these children and these future workers, instead of, like, allowing, for me personally, like, by having an abortion when I had an abortion, and then creating the family when I felt I was ready and able to create that family, I'm able to give my children and pour into my children in a way that I would not have been able to when I first got pregnant. And that is something I talk to family members who don't necessarily support abortion about all the time. And I'm like, you're in my house? This house is possible because I waited to have a child and establish myself in my career and like was able to, you know, carve out the time for that. And then being able to, when I'm done working, sit down and play with my children because I'm not as focused on the grind that we're forced into by capitalism. And people don't like to talk about that, like that abortion access is about our ability to actually live our lives fully versus being a product of the system, which is what they want and which is why they're attacking abortion access.
Mm-hmm. Say that. So I resonate a lot with Rosie's story. I've had abortions and I have children. I have four beautiful children. Ages range from 22 to 11. And so much of my life.
I can't believe Naima is 11.
I know. Naima is definitely the movement baby. This was post my abortion that Chicago Abortion Fund funded. She grew up in this.
If you watch the documentary Ours to Tell, you can go to We Testify's website and watch it. Brittany's in it. And so is Naima cracking an egg all over the bowl. It's the cutest moment.
The counter and everything.
Movement baby. Wow, 11. Okay, sorry, continue.
Yes. We'll be 12 this winter. But I resonate with her story so much as someone who, I had three children at the time, all under the age of 5, I believe. And I was like, hell no, I want to pivot and do some different things, and couldn't afford my procedure. So much, much, much love to the Chicago Abortion Fund, which is where I learned about reproductive justice, where I learned about the Hyde Amendment, and I just couldn't fathom not being able to use my insurance when I had just given birth to three babies through Medicaid insurance. And so I was like, oh, this is a thing? Well, one, abortion funds are a thing first, because I didn't know that either. I didn't know about reproductive justice, didn't know about the Hyde Amendment. And so being involved in that organization and later being the executive director and transitioning out and now at the National Network of Abortion Funds, all of that work has really been able to like help me see all the inequities that you all have talked about in your excerpts. And so, Regina, I want to ask you, in your reading, you highlighted reproductive justice as an economic issue, economic justice issue, and a reproductive justice, and how they're both, written about and talked about, like how the capitalist healthcare system mm-hmm. and two-party electoral system has mm-hmm. undermined abortion access and repro healthcare and access. And can you share a bit about some of that? I know that's a lot, that's a mouthful, yeah. But if you can share some of that and what you found in your research.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for the question. So I think it's really important to go way back, like way, way back, to better understand how reproductive justice and economic justice and capitalism all intersect in these horrible ways under the healthcare system that we have in the United States. So prior to the criminalization of abortion in ancient times, which we get into deep in the book, people had abortions using herbs in their garden. We have a few of those on the cover, pennyroyal, Queen Anne's lace, or people drank teas and concoctions in their grandmother's house, their neighbor's house. Access was not dependent on your status or income because people were relying on abortion methods that had been passed down through the generations, through trial and error. But in the late 1800s, when the American Medical Association and Horatio Storer, in particular, launched his crusade against abortion, he laid the foundation for what we're seeing today, which is the present-day capitalist anti-abortion movement, and in particular, the medicalization of childbirth and labor. What the American Medical Association at the time did in the 1800s was made it so that only doctors could provide abortion. So instead of people going out to their, you know, gardens or to the neighbor's house to get, you know, to get the concoctions that they wanted to have their abortions, those people were being delegitimized, stigmatized, identified as quacks, and it was a system in which only the white male doctors, because at that time the only people in the AMA were white doctors, black folks weren't allowed to be part of it, women weren't allowed to be part of it. The white male doctors were taking over the healthcare system, basically professionalizing, which we've heard that word a lot this weekend, professionalizing the healthcare system and making it so that only they could provide abortions and provide reproductive healthcare and maternal healthcare. And what happened? There were spikes in increases in maternal mortality and infant mortality because they didn't know what the fuck they were doing, right? Like they kicked out the people who were experts, the people who had labor, had abortions, and instead were trying to control this, creating this system of control. They were all being driven, at the time, the American Medical Association, Horatio Store, were all being driven by this idea of the white replacement theory, that the immigrants in this country, the black people who were getting free at the time, the women who were, demanding access to contraception and abortion, that white people were going to be outnumbered. Because white women were wanted to have abortions, wanted to control their family size, and then non-black people and non-white people were having babies and wanted access to social services for those babies and for their families. And so this was a way to control our society and who got to reproduce, who died from reproducing, all of those things. So the other thing that happened decades later was the formation of the Medicaid program. We explain in our book the context in which this huge program was created. It's important to see it as part of the civil rights movement, right? Because this was a way for the desegregation of hospitals, the desegregation of healthcare for black people to actually have access to care, to doctors, as part of Medicaid and Medicare that was signed into law by Lyndon B. Johnson. President Harry Truman was actually the first president to introduce this concept of public insurance in 1945. And critics like the American Medical Association called it communism or socialized medicine. So this is not new that people are calling it. This goes back decades, right?
And time is a circle.
Yes. But unfortunately, the unfortunate thing about the Medicaid program was that it was structured after the welfare programs that came before it. In other words, it allowed states to opt in to the program, because of course states are getting federal funding, states are applying their own funding to then provide the people in their states with access to care, and which states were late, delayed on opting in? States in the South, states with large concentrations of black people, of people of color. And so once they did adopt it, they were very successful at creating other ways to then prevent who could actually be part of the Medicaid program, and this is the racism that's embedded within the Medicaid program that still exists today in lots of ways. We go into the full history in the book. So come to 1976, Representative Henry Hyde in Illinois, he's the representative of Illinois, introduces this budget rider called the Hyde Amendment we've been talking about, and that really became the tool by the right to block access to abortion care. And so we've talked about the Hyde Amendment, but just to explain, so the way that it works, it's attached every year to healthcare spending bills. It's not a law. Lawmakers are actively, every time they're passing a budget, actively attaching and approving, voting on this rider, right? So it's really important to understand how that actually works. And we talked about all the groups in the excerpt who are affected by it. So the result of this system means that we now have this two-tiered healthcare system in this country where people with money, we've talked about this in the excerpt, but just to reiterate, people with money can access healthcare, people who are on Medicaid have limited access, the government gets to decide which parts of the healthcare system they can participate in. And I think it's really important to note that Medicaid fully covers prenatal care and childbirth, and also if you want to be sterilized. And Brittany, when we spoke, you talked about how that was your experience, right? Because you were on Medicaid when you had, I can't remember if it was the name, but they had brought you the form. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to share that story.
I can briefly. So after the birth of my third daughter, this was 2007, the hospital kind of brought me in these forms for tubal ligation. And I was like, okay, sure, I'll think about it, because I was afraid to say, hell no, I didn't ask for this shit. But that's, I mean, they were trying to coerce me into tying my tubes. But, you know, shout out to my intuition and listening, saying, hell no.
Hey, your body said,
My body was like, hold up.
There is a session on, I believe it's on Friday, about care washing. But this is this, right? Like, it's this way of saying, like, we'll give you benefits. We want to help you. Mm-hmm. We want to, you know, make sure that you can access the care that you need. But, oh, let me just also control, you know, or encourage you to get sterilized and things like that. So anyway, so we come back to this system of reproductive control. And there are other programs, not just Medicaid. There's the Title X Family Planning Program, and that restricts clinics that provide things like contraception, HIV and AIDS prevention and testing. They can't talk about abortion using these Title X dollars. And so again, they found other ways, like, oh, we'll offer sexual and reproductive health care, but we're gonna isolate abortion out of all of this. And we also see this internationally, because we've been talking about imperialism this weekend. The Helms Amendment, the Mexico City policy, you know, under Republican administrations, these rules have gone so far as that people can't use non-US money for abortions. Like, that's one of the rules if you receive federal funding from the United States. So the United States is not only controlling our systems of healthcare also outside of the United States, which is
wild. Can I also just add that y'all's current pro-choice president hasn't repealed the Helms Amendment. Mm-hmm. Well, he did leave the Hyde Amendment off of his budget for 4 years, so he can get one finger of a high five for that. But yeah, internationally, he's still actually very anti-abortion. Don't let them lie to you.
So we've been talking about abortion funds. Abortion funds really stepped in to fill this massive gap because of the Hyde Amendment. And the very first one, it's important to note, was created after Rosie Jimenez's death. And it was created in Texas as a way for the feminists at the time, they wanted to support other, to prevent the next Rosie, right? Like, they wanted to support other people. And then it's become this national, as Brittany at the National Network of Abortion Funds, national network of abortion funds around the country. I'll just wrap up and say, you know, again, like, I think it's so important to see that Rosie's story was really a failure, not just of the Hyde Amendment and the Democrats' lack of ability to stop attaching it to riders, right? But also because of the fact that our healthcare system is structured in a way where, to go back to this idea of care washing, that we can help people but control their decisions in the process of helping them.
Thank you. Speaking of Biden,
my favorite person,
babes. All right, so in the book, y'all have images of black and brown folks, right, who were organizing for free, safe abortions in New York in the 60s. And Renee, earlier this year, President Biden said that he wasn't for, quote, abortion on demand. And the president of Planned Parenthood called abortion on demand a right-wing talking point. So, right. You then replied with an explainer on the history of the term and its socialist and radical roots. Do you want to share more about that?
I would love to.
Go for it.
I would love to. So this is why we read books, everyone. And this is why we learn our organizing history, because otherwise we will then fall into the same traps that the opposition has set for us. So, you know, she said, quote, abortion on demand is right-wing language that reinforces stigma and spreads misinformation. Abortion is healthcare. The only thing we demand is full equality. I agree with that part, the last part. Now, I just wanted to add to the confusion, because giving the historical context, abortion on demand was actually a socialist demand. It was pre-legalization, and the connotation has changed over 50 years to sort of become this meaning later abortion, which is what Biden was using it as, and what the president of Planned Parenthood was using it as, right? But originally, and let me just, it was like a dictionary definition. Dictionary.com literally defines abortion on demand as the right of a woman to have an abortion during the first 6 months of pregnancy. I mean, they're making that part up, but sure. Or an abortion performed on a woman solely at her own request. Solely at her own request. That is what abortion on demand is. That you get to decide if, when, and how you get your abortion. That is what it means, right? But the term originated in the 1960s and 70s, and it was a call to action because at the time, the abortions that were legalized in just a couple states were not on demand. They were upon request. And that meant that someone would have to have usually a health indication. At the time, people were taking a medication called thalidomide, and that was causing birth defects. And there were a couple other medications that were doing the same thing. And this is where ableism comes in. They didn't want these usually middle-class white women as part of the baby who were having babies as part of like the baby boom to have these disabled children. So they would provide them with abortions to spare them having to have a disabled child. It was thalidomide was the medication that they were taking, and rubella or German measles was also causing birth defects at the time. So you could go to a doctor and say, hey, I was exposed to, I was taking thalidomide, or I had German measles while I was pregnant. And then the doctor would say, okay, you're clear to get an abortion. Not unlike today, actually, because you have to be septic, you have to be super sick, and then they'll say, okay, you qualify for in the case of life or the health of a pregnant person. So that is actually something that Alan Guttmacher, Guttmacher Institute, it's a research abortion research organization, he actually pioneered. So our movement set that up. They set it up as a half measure in hopes to legalize abortion. But as we know, that didn't actually help anyone, which is why half measures don't work. It's abortion for everyone or no one. So what they were then arguing for, abortion on demand, was saying remove the doctor as that middleman and say that you get to decide. Also at the time, people were lying and saying that they were suicidal and saying like because they knew that's what they had to say. Others were telling the truth that they, if they continue this pregnancy, they were going to get kicked out of their home. They were like going to kill themselves. Some people did. My aunt, we tell her story in the book, she was like, I knew that that's what I had to say, and that's what I had to tell a doctor, because that was the only way. Now, that isn't even an acceptable health indication, because people were lying. Or, it's an invisible disability, so it's not real. It's all in your head. So, there's parts of abortion on demand that we actually should go back to because they took people more seriously then than they did now. Of course, access sucked. Yes, it's complicated. Anyway, so abortion on demand, again, was the alternative to quote-unquote elective abortions. Again, at the time, they were fighting the sterilization of black and brown people. So they were also calling for natural birth on demand. The ability to have children on demand, right? So this was a term. Later, it kind of dropped once we got legalization. They stopped saying on demand. And then as the repro movement became very professionalized and wanted to be accepted by the political movement, and it lost its radical roots, it lost its connection to socialism and to communist Marxist organizing, all the radical folks. That is when they wanted to be accepted by the mainstream left. I don't know, what are Democrats these days? Republican lights? So they wanted to be accepted by them. And then the movement became professionalized, and most of the organizations at the time were run by lawyers. What are lawyers? Risk averse. They also are like, Okay, I'm just going to expose all our movement secrets. Half of them are married to people at the corporations. Like, they're not interested in an entire movement shift. So abortion on demand was dropped as an ask. And this became a fight also because the larger organizations went with Roe happening. The radical folks were like, Roe sucks, which is what we're saying now. Because they knew that Roe was a half measure and wouldn't cover everyone. So anyway, they dropped this term, abortion on demand. What do the antis do with everything we drop? Pick it up. And so then they start saying abortion on demand as a slur or as a nasty term, meaning like later abortion. Then you have people sort of moving, again, like them using it in this term, and then Democrats responding to that, not defending abortion because they couldn't be seen doing that. But then you have Nancy Pelosi in 2018, during the midterm elections with Trump, they're trying to win back the House, not only allowing no litmus test on abortion and allowing anti-abortion candidates to run as Democrats, but also to then say, I'm also not for abortion on demand, legitimizing that abortion on demand, later abortion, is not a legitimate thing to defend. Now, fast forward, we have the president of Planned Parenthood saying that that abortion on demand is a right-wing term. We also have conservatives saying that abortion is on demand is not only later abortion, but it's getting pills in the mail, which literally, yeah, it is on abortion on demand. They're actually right on that one. It is. It is when you want it and when you need it. My argument is that we need to challenge that, and we need to embrace abortion on demand. And for those of you, so one, we're going to do like a little conversation in just a second, but for all of you who are sitting in the chairs, there's these little pieces of paper. And we put in there the photos that are in the book, and you can see the signs. To be clear, these photos, I didn't just print them in black and white. They're literally black and white photos because they're from the 60s and 70s. These are the demands. Huh? I mean, yes. The ones that, well, Getty apparently doesn't. But what I wanted you to see is that our demands used to be radical. It was free abortion. It was abortion on demand. We have the right call. We know that. What we need to do is keep pushing for that, and that is needs to be part of a socialist agenda. Sorry, that was a really long answer, but.
it was a beautiful answer. Do we want to answer the last question? And then
let's do that.
So we have one more question for the panel, and then we'll get into the peer shares. So, what does liberated? My bad. What does liberated abortion look like to y'all, and particularly within the socialist organizing framework? And I think you hinted at some of that, Renee.
Yeah,
I think there are two ways of looking at it. So, in the book, and you know, the first way example I'll give is of reform, and we've been talking about reforms. You know, can go either way because it gives the right, or not even just the right, but like Democrats an opportunity to make it less than what it really should be. But there is an opportunity for a potential reform. So we share the story in the book of Sarah Michael Hammond. So she's a person that really comes to mind when I think about a way of expanding access in states right now. So Sarah was a minor in the state of California when she found out she was pregnant and needed an abortion. She knew another friend who had gone to a local clinic and was able to get to qualify for the state's Medi-Cal program. And so that's what Sarah did. When she went to the clinic, you know, you fill out the form and you can check a box basically that says like, what's your income? And she put like $0. And that gave her presumptive eligibility for the state's Medi-Cal program, which covers abortion as basic healthcare. And so she didn't have to tell her parents. She didn't have to use their insurance, and as Renee was talking about, like, have an EOB, an explanation of benefits, sent to her home that then explained, like, oh, you had an abortion, and this is how much it cost. She didn't have to worry about any of that. She could just use the state's health insurance, and nobody knew. And she told us she still uses Medi-Cal today because it's that good, like, it just the way that it worked. And that's a state-based program. So that's just one example in terms of, like, what I see as, like, short-term liberating abortion, where it's, like, you're a minor, you don't have to get permission, you just go to the doctor, you check a box, and then you get your abortion. But then, of course, the long term, right? Like, how within, so we argue in the book that liberating abortion is not gonna come from systemic changes. And so even though we're talking about changing a system, we're really not talking about changing a system. We're talking about how all of us show up for one another, and for our family members and our communities inside the United States and outside the United States. And so, you know, that could look like, as we talk about in the book, like pills in our cabinets, because you never know who's gonna need an abortion, or as the Janes, which we talk about in the book, the Jane Collective from the Abortion Counseling Service from Chicago, and other radical activists like Pat McGinnis, that looks like transforming our ideas of care. So that it's more, and someone said this on Friday morning at the Reproductive Justice Strategy Session, that abortion is more of self-help than this, just like it within the medical system and the medical framework. And so on a larger scale, it's really about abolition. It's about, you know, defunding the systems that don't serve us, and funding and investing in our communities, and funding the resources that would actually help us and allow people to really live their lives and thrive.
I'm glad you talked about policy. I'm gonna talk about vibes.
Yes. Yes.
Because liberating abortion is a vibe. Mm-hmm. I think that it's like, yes, there are gonna be policies and things that, thank you, that people need for, like, the literal, like, getting their abortions. But I also think liberating abortion is a way in which people can feel like they have everything they need to make the decision that's best for them, and not have to worry or hustle or figure out how they have to hack a system or question who they can trust. It is like there is a piece of it that is, yes, the policies that we can set up, but it's also what we can do as a community in how we show up for one another, how we trust each other, how we care for each other, right? And how do we, that to me, that also then means that there are people who are having abortions because they can't afford additional children, but they actually would like to parent. There's also a really great book called Relinquished by Dr. Gretchen Sisson, and it's about how adoption economics coerces people into adoption. People who place for adoption actually would like to parent, but they did not have the resources and the support to be able to do so. They were uninterested in abortion. They actually just wanted to parent. And so how do we make parenting, how do we make abortion, how do we make all of these decisions actually accessible and acceptable for all of us to choose? I do think that it is that everyone gets to have the abortion that they desire, whether that is at home with a doula, with their loved ones, with a friend, by your damn self, because you're like, I just need to get through this and I don't feel like talking to anybody. I just want to watch a movie and do this mm-hmm. on my own. Mm-hmm. That you can safely self-manage your abortion with pills, without fearing criminalization, without fearing that if in the rare case you do have complications, or you just have a question, you're like, I don't know, I want to go to the doc, say, I think I'm bleeding a little bit much, not fearing that that social worker is going to turn you in. Because there was a panel on social work and the way it's, they're just agents of the state, but most people who are criminalized for the outcomes of their pregnancies are turned in not directly by the cops, but the doctors, nurses, and social workers at the hospital. The people you trust to help you when you think you're in a crisis or you are in a crisis. Because abortion is super safe, so most people, they see blood, they don't know what's the right amount of blood. So they think they're bleeding a lot and it's actually quite normal and they're fine. But they think, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm in a crisis. So they go for help. That is how they get caught up in the system. That's a problem. And instead of just giving them the health care that they needed, giving them, maybe they wanted an in-clinic procedure, but they didn't fit, they couldn't afford it, they couldn't get to it, so they're self-managing at home, or they just wanted to, right? They're in fear, or now in fear of criminalization, or literally in jail. And it takes a team of folks to get them out. And even if we do get their records expunged, or they're in jail, you know, only overnight, that is a huge issue. Like, that is a huge traumatic moment in your life that people, we don't really think of it. And I'll just spill some movement tea. I'm having fights with people who are like, well, I don't want to talk to them about the risk of criminalization with the SHIELD laws. Does anyone know what SHIELD laws are? So SHIELD laws, if you're not familiar, Illinois doesn't have one, but it's where the provider can provide an abortion via telemedicine into a state where abortion is criminalized, and the provider will not be criminalized. Sounds great. It's like 70% there. The person having the abortion is still subject to criminalization. There are doctors and organizations who do this work on SHIELD work. They do not feel like they should have to tell their patient that they are subject to criminalization. And I'm going to tell you there are two ridiculous-ass reasons. One, it might scare them off. Let me tell you right now, as somebody who's been pregnant and didn't want to be, and shit's scaring me off. I would just like to know what I'm up against and what I shouldn't do, and shit's scaring me off. The second one is that the number of people who have been criminalized for the outcomes of their pregnancies is exceedingly rare. It's actually so rare that we wouldn't even have to report it in a medical journal. So why would we have to tell them? What? I'm sorry, you go spend a night in jail. You guys went and got a whole law for you because you don't want to spend a night in jail. But you're willing to let your patients who are low income and folks of color do that? Fuck you. Truly fuck you. So this is why I only advocate for people who have abortions now. No, nobody else. But to me, again, like, liberated abortion is a vibe that you should be able to access that care without that fear, and you should be able to get all of the resources that you need, and people give you all of the information that you need. Because I think what they're doing is coercive, and it's not liberated abortion. It might be accessible, but for whom and for how long? So anyway, I'll leave it there because we have to let you guys talk.
Yeah, we do. We do. Thank you both for that. Hearing how abortion is a community care and responsibility, mm-hmm. That's kind of like what I'm taking away from that last piece. So. And also with the blood and the self-managed abortions. Yep. Like, I did not call the doctor. I reached out to We Testify.
Yep.
tell me how, you know, share the tea. I don't know what's going on, but I'm not calling, nope. I'm not going to the doctor. So anyway, we're going to spend a shortened amount of time with y'all in some pairs answering, I'm going to say about three questions. You can pick whichever one. But you're going to find a partner. You absolutely must. So share some assumptions y'all had about abortion before coming into this session. And what are some things you were surprised to learn? Also,
Just read. The questions are on the little piece of paper. They're on a, yeah. You have the little piece of paper. So if you're on this. Oh, sorry.
Oh, there we go.
Yes. But just so folks know, they're, if you're on this side of the paper. The side of the room, come get some stickers and the sheet of paper. And then Brittany can read all of the questions for the translation we have in the background of the room.
Got it. All right. So read the first one about assumptions. I think you get that one? Okay. How have you seen abortion as an economic justice issue in the past? Why do you think abortion is essential to racial and gender justice? What does abortion access look like in your community? What would it look like to consider abortion as a social good and integral to our nation's social safety net? How does access to abortion inform your orientation to socialism? What does liberated abortion look like to you all, particularly within the socialist organizing framework? What do you want to learn more about? What are you interested in exploring more? And what are you still pondering? And what do you still need info on? All right, you have about 5 to 7 minutes.
Because we want to leave time for you guys to have Q&A.
Yes.
Too, just a little bit.
Don't be shy.
Make a friend.
Yeah. We're bringing you all back.
If you can hear my voice, say the word abortion.
All right.
If you can hear my voice, say the word abortion twice.
Right. All right. So, no more clapping. All right, y'all. I hope that was fruitful. Y'all made some connections. I see y'all still in the mix, but I do wanna open it up for folks to ask Renee and Regina a couple of questions. We have time for maybe two questions.
I mean, we can stay late too, but
I mean, I can.
I do have to pump.
Yes. We wanted to open up for Q&A. Don't all get all quiet at once.
Oh, I see you.
Go ahead. Come on, Emily. Oh, go ahead. Can you use the mic?
Oh.
Yeah, no, for the translation so they can all hear you all the way in the back. Yeah, of course. Sure. We'll take it on.
It's welcome.
We'll take a question, a comment question.
Is this on?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. You have to by the rules.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not a rule follower.
Yeah. Which is why we're all here.
Right.
I've been sitting here, and I've had 3 abortions. Mm. I have 2 children.
Mm-hmm.
The one that I'm going to talk about a little bit in terms of what my question is. Mm-hmm. Is I'm clearly white and come from economic privilege, and I had an abortion at 6.5 months, mm-hmm. Which is considered very late term. Mm-hmm. It was not a viable pregnancy, mm-hmm. and so. I knew I wanted to have kids. It was in between my first daughter and our second daughter. And I knew that when the time was right for us, mm-hmm. I did want to be able to have another child. Mm-hmm. So I sought out the most, like, I thought safe way to do it, which is a natural way with seaweed. And mm-hmm. I went to a private clinic that was hidden behind bushes and didn't take insurance.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I was able to control mm-hmm. a safe way for me to do it. And I know giving money is always an important thing that I can do to whatever means we can, but I feel so much the question about it being about economics and race and women's rights, it is so emotional to me because I have had that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so my question was like, how can I find the appropriate space and place to be able to be an advocate for other women to be able to make that choice that I was privileged enough to have?
Yeah, I love this question. Thank you. I'll just share some thoughts on if you want to. Yeah. So, because this is like my job, right, is working with people who share their abortion stories. And although my organization like centers and works majority with people of color who've had abortions and folks who experience financial barriers, right? We have people who kind of run the gamut. And I think stories like yours are ones that like folks want in the mainstream because there's this, sounds weird, but it's this like pronatalist narrative. You saw it with the Democrats where it was like, they wanted to have the pregnancy, to continue the pregnancy. They wanted a baby. But, you know, the only thing that forced them to have an abortion was that there was a medical indication, right? And so it's still sort of this, like, I wouldn't have had an abortion except for, you know, this meddling health indication. But there's not a lot of space for people who had abortions just because they didn't want to be pregnant. Right. So no, this is why I think you're great, right? There's not a lot of space for those stories. And we've seen, I have storytellers who've been encouraged to share the health indication story and not their other story of having an abortion when they needed it. What I would offer to you is to continue to share all of your stories and the context of all of them. And why each and every one of those abortions mattered, because one, most people have abortions have already had more than one. That's something we don't hear a lot, is multiple abortion stories. So talking about that. But also, people are going to automatically be drawn to you and listen to you because you are white and because you come from an economically privileged background and you have that health indication story as one of your stories. So that is a way for you to then draw them in, to then not only talk about your other abortions, but then say, because I was able to have these things, this is how I was able to do this. Most people who have abortions don't actually have this, and talk about the privilege and the racial aspect of it. I didn't have people saying racist things to me outside of the clinic. I didn't have people treating me this way. I can say that I have had three abortions, and you don't judge me as much as you might someone who is an immigrant or who is black or brown, right? To name that, because I think one of the shortfalls of the storytellers who are telling the health indication stories, the white married couple acceptable abortions, let's just call them, is that they tell their story, but they then don't place it in the larger context of everyone else. And to me, that just exudes and exemplifies a bit of white privilege instead of where's the lifting as we climb piece. You have been given a stage and you have been given a platform. Use it to talk about what other people are doing it. Don't just do just yourself. Does that make sense? We love all abortion storytellers. thank you for sharing. Yeah. Do you have a question? Come to the. Oh, go ahead.
Just
come to the mic though for the sound for so that everyone, because sometimes it's hard for people to hear. I am someone who it can be hard for me to hear, and also for translation too.
Hi, I'm Fred from New York City. I remember this banner because I was in the Socialist Party at the time.
And so was my dad. He was very proud of it.
Oh, we'll have to talk. So, and it says free abortion on demand,
mm-hmm.
Which was, I think, in retrospect, an important
yep.
part of the struggle. But I also know that not long after this, we dropped the demand free.
Mm-hmm.
And just called for abortion on demand.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because we were in coalition with other groups that didn't want to talk about free healthcare or socialized medicine or anything. It would raise so many other questions. But I'm just curious about what you think in terms of, obviously, the goal, the program is free abortion on demand. But is it more strategic to talk about abortion rights, the right to abortion, liberating abortion, without at the same time bringing in the economic side of it. It's complicated, so
yeah,
just
no,
see what you thought.
It is extremely complicated. And it touches on, I have like 14 ways of it, and I'm sure you do, 14 different ways of answering this, because it touches on a lot of different things too. There's the economic justice, but there's also the part of it where we're pushing people to not just talk about women having abortion. Like I feel like all of these things are connected. Like how we talk about what we're asking for is really important. And so it's not just that women have abortions, but people have abortions, and it's not just that we want abortion on demand, we want free abortion on demand. Because if we start to, we'll be doing what the Democrats did mm-hmm. in the 90s, in terms of giving away our power, because this is a power fight more than anything else. And we are actually, there are more of us who are interested in this than we give ourselves credit for, and we often shy away from being explicit about what it is we're demanding because we're trying to be likable, we want to like get widespread interest, and so I feel like, yeah, there's more I want to say, but we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, I'll wrap up because I know we're almost at time, but we're at time, but I think we have to articulate what our vision is. We advocate in this book for cost-free abortions, and I'm going to tell you right now, that is not something that the movement is advocating for, and you will not see the largest organizations in our movement endorse this book, and that's okay, because at the end of the day, like, that's why you didn't see Planned Parenthood endorse Medicaid for All or Medicare for All. Like, you see them still, like, half the clinics don't accept insurance because it's really difficult, but also they don't accept Medicaid because the Medicaid insurance reimbursement rates are so low. That is something, if you live here in Illinois or any other like blue state, that you can fight for to as a step on the way to cost-free abortions. To me, that is where we're headed. What are the ways that we can reduce the costs along the way for the for people having abortions? Because if abortion is not free, it's not actually on demand. Because there will always be someone who cannot afford it. And so at the end of the day, like, it needs to be available in taco trucks on every corner. Remember they said that for the abortion clinics on every corner. You deserve access, because when you have an abortion clinic, and not just access to pills, but abortion clinics in your community, you have a safe place to go if you're experiencing an intimate partner violence. You have a safe place to go with any gynecological or reproductive health care you need. You can go get a vasectomy. You have trans health care, because a lot of abortion clinics, they're really good at stigmatized health care. So if we, our argument is that if we center all of the needs of abortions, of everyone who needs abortions, low-income folks, immigrants, Black and brown folks, incarcerated people, queer and trans folks, you actually can liberate the entire system for everyone. Because every issue that you care about, whether it's climate justice or incarceration, has an intersection with pregnancy decision making. So we hope you'll read the book and enjoy and learn more.
I mean, just go. I think we're gonna wrap. One more? Do we have somebody?
Do we have one more? I want to wrap, just in case. I know I don't want to hold people beyond their time, but thank you for coming.
Yeah. Thank
Liberatingabortion.org and .com and all
October
the URLs.
1st.
And take your stickers, please. It's out October 1st. Come chat with us if you have more thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. This is our first event for the book.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.